The day after, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump claims victory.
We saw the candidates that I supported achieve tremendous success last night.
And right after that news conference came this news. Jeff Sessions is out as Attorney General. The Democrats also chalked up victories, including the first Somali-American woman elected to Congress. Ilhan Omar told supporters that America still promises to be the land of opportunity for immigrants.
I could not stand by on the sidelines and watch those promises go unkept.
Plus, a film crew from Australia watches Americans vote and comes away with this.
We think America is an unhappy place right now.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The 2018 midterms are all over but the shouting. There's plenty of shouting, though.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question, are you worried?
That's enough.
President Trump today in what can only be described as an off-the-rails news conference. Soon after that wrapped up, news broke that Attorney General Jeff Sessions will be leaving his job. We're following that, along with other ways the midterms will have an impact on trade, immigration, climate change, and U.S. foreign policy. Let's start with one of the big headlines from yesterday's vote. It was a huge night for women.
This is the story of this election cycle. Women stepping up to lead, to take back our country and take back the agenda in Washington.
That's Jackie Rosen, who won a tight race in Nevada for the Senate. In the House, a record number of women will now serve. The outgoing Congress had set the previous record for women members at 84. Now that number is expected to go over 100. Two women in particular broke new ground. Michigan Democrat Rashida Tlaib became one of two Muslim women, the first ever to win congressional seats. The other, Ilhan Omar, in Minnesota's 5th congressional district. Omar is also the first Somali to win a House seat. The World's Allison Herrera is in Minneapolis, and she was at Ilhan Omar's victory party last night. So, Allison, Omar's victory seems like a pretty big deal.
It is a big deal, and it also isn't a big deal. I talked with a number of Somali women that were there at the victory party, and they said, you know, it's a big deal for them to have somebody elected that looks like them, that they feel is going to represent their interests. And it isn't a big deal in that Minnesota's 5th congressional district is pretty solidly blue. And Ilhan Omar's predecessor, Keith Ellison, was the first Muslim elected to Congress, and he really paved the way for her candidacy. She really swept into office. I mean, there was really no question. She won 78% of the vote. Ilhan Omar talked last night at her victory party about how important it was that a refugee, a Somali woman, was elected to Congress. She also said something to the effect of, in Minnesota, we don't just welcome refugees, we send them to Washington.
Immigrants promised the land of opportunity are too often met with bigotry and hate. I could not stand by on the sidelines and watch those promises go unkept.
Any other firsts where women are concerned?
Yes. Two Native American women are going to be going to Congress next year. That is Sharice Davids in Kansas' 3rd District and Deb Holland in New Mexico's 1st District. Also in Minnesota, Peggy Flanagan won the lieutenant governorship alongside Tim Walz. She's going to be the first Native American woman to hold that office.
So two Native Americans going to Congress and one lieutenant governor in Minnesota. There were 54 Native Americans, though, running state and locally. Is this a record?
It is something of a record, absolutely. And I asked Peggy Flanagan, the newly elected lieutenant governor of Minnesota, why so many Native American women were running for office this time around.
You know, some folks have said, like, oh, is it a response to Donald Trump? And, you know, I think in some ways that cheapens what we've been trying to do, which is, you know, for a long time, Native folks have been registering to vote, turning out to vote, flipping seats across the country, and it is the natural next step that we would run for office ourselves.
Are there any political differences between the Native American candidates who won? Are they all Democrats?
That's great that you asked that question, Marco, because there actually was, here in Minnesota, there was a Republican lieutenant governor that was running, and she was from the Red Lake Nation, Donna Bergstrom.
But she lost to Peggy Flanagan, correct?
She lost to Peggy Flanagan, yes.
Another Native American.
Another Native American.
The World's Allison Herrera at the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in Minneapolis. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marco.
By the way, we have a list of all the history-making women from yesterday's election. That's at theworld.org. North of the border in Canada, more women are winning elections than ever at the federal and provincial level. Quebec held a vote in early October. There are 125 seats in the provincial legislature in Quebec, and women now hold 52 of them. That's a national record. Pascal Navarro is a writer and women's rights advocate in Montreal. You were watching the U.S. midterms from Quebec. What do the results look like from where you're sitting?
Well, we knew that it wouldn't be a big change. Everything won't change in one day. But we could see that more women from the base, that means more women that are non-political professionals, you know, that came to run for politics. And that for us was the big change.
And what about in Quebec? I mean, did you have that kind of diverse spread of women candidates now that there's 40% of the seats in Quebec's provincial government with women? Who are they?
We have a more diverse women population candidates, but it's true that here, like in any other country, politics was always a secret garden. I mean, you have to know people. We have preoccupations to have more women coming from different professional environment and also from different social status and also different origins.
Quebec's had its ups and downs when it comes to women making progress in provincial government. But as of October, women now hold more than 40% of the seats in the province.
Yeah.
What was behind that victory in October?
Behind that was a lot of energy put by women and men also, but the women's group meeting politicians, meeting political parties, and trying to convince them what is important in women being in politics.
And how long did that education process take?
About 3 years since the election of Justin Trudeau at the federal level, 2015, and he made a cabinet with half women, half men. And everybody was so surprised and charmed, and what a man, what a modern man, what a modern politician. Yeah. So we could come back in Quebec and told them to the government of Quebec, you see, he did that in Ottawa. You can do that here too. But for that, you need to have female candidates.
So with so many women in Quebec's provincial government, how is that going to affect politics in the province going forward?
I think that here, what is important for women in all parties is to be able to represent all the women in Quebec. So we have a conversation about getting more women to speak for women and to do politics as women. I know it sounds weird, but what I mean there is that usually when women go in politics, they just fit the model, the role model of the political men, you know? They don't take time to develop their own vision of politics. And I think that this is what is changing right now. And we have some women in the left wing, mostly also on the right, but on the left, that are really doing politics as women. So they don't erase their womanhood because they're in politics. But the problem is that if we have to wait for shocks and scandals and catastrophe to have more women, we have a problem. It should be seen as a democratic rule. You know, it should be seen as an ideal to have women and men in equality in cabinets or in member of parliaments, in governments. And this is what I think is so sad, that we have to wait to have a president like Mr. Trump. I'm sorry, but it's really a shock for us.
So you see the arrival of Trump as the trigger for all these women candidates and victories in the U.S.?
Oh, yes. I remember having this conversation 2 years ago with a woman here that works on American politics. And she was very disappointed with him, saying that it would be terrible for women. And I said, yeah, maybe it would be terrible, but you'll see, they will react. And that's what happened.
Quebecoise Pascal Navarro is an author and journalist. She joined us from Montreal. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks to you.
Talk about bearing the lead. Donald Trump gave the longest news conference of his presidency today, almost 90 minutes, and he never confirmed what happened straight after. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is out. His replacement, for the time being at least, is Matthew Whitaker. He was serving as Sessions' chief of staff. David Korn is Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones, and in retrospect, David, Trump did seem to drop a hint during today's wild news conference.
I'm very happy with most of my cabinet. We're looking at different people for different positions. You know, it's very common after the midterms. I didn't want to do anything before the midterms. But I will tell you that, for the most part, I'm extremely happy with my cabinet.
Yeah, David Corn in Washington, the day after the midterm, Sessions is out. How surprised are you?
Not surprised at all. Donald Trump, for over a year, has signaled that he hates Jeff Sessions, that he considered it a big mistake to make him attorney general. He's called it. He's called it a terrible mistake. Those are Trump's own words. He's been offended that Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Trump-Russia investigation being overseen by special counsel Robert Mueller, and seems to believe that it's the attorney general's job to protect Trump from investigations, not to serve the public good. So the only surprise that might have been possible here would have been if Sessions stayed on in the position.
Mm. Well, he often humiliated Sessions ruthlessly in public. Does it all go back to Sessions recusing himself from the investigation? Is that what Trump's unhappiness with him is all about?
That seems to be what Trump complains about publicly the most. And he's complained about it repeatedly, saying that if he had known that Sessions was going to recuse himself, he never would have nominated him. And he blames Sessions for not even telling him or raising that when they were discussing the appointment initially. So he has basically humiliated Sessions in public now for months. And the letter that Sessions sent in for his resignation, you know, starts with the phrase, as you've requested. So it's quite clear that Trump, at some point, maybe even before the midterms election, because I understand that the letter's not dated, told Sessions he wanted his resignation letter on his desk, and he would, you know, reveal it, use it, make it active after the election. So not surprising at all. And what this means is that another Trump appointee, an acting attorney general, Whitaker, who has been critical of the Mueller investigation and commentaries that he's put up on the CNN website, where he used to be a commentator, is now in charge of overseeing the Mueller investigation, according to the Justice Department.
And what are you anticipating in terms of how Matthew Whitaker, Sessions' acting replacement, is going to proceed and act at this point?
I don't know. I think it's a big question right now. You know, he's publicly on the record as saying that the investigation should not go too far, should not widen, and that Rod Rosenstein, who was in charge of it, should have been making sure that the investigation stayed in a rather confined, narrow lane. So is that what he's going to do now? We also don't know where Mueller is in this investigation. He only recently got access to everything that Paul Manafort knows. Michael Cohen started cooperating, you know, a couple weeks ago as well. Both of those developments could have led Mueller to start looking in lots of different directions. So now does he have to get permission to do that from Whitaker? And is Whitaker really there to keep this investigation narrow, or is he there to finally kill it?
Can Matthew Whitaker do all that? Is he empowered?
Well, Matthew Whitaker presumably has the ability to fire Robert Mueller. Now, under Justice Department guidelines, it's my understanding that he can only fire Mueller for cause. But we do have, you know, we've seen Trump yell and scream that Mueller has conflicts of interest and so on and so forth. So there might be a way for the White House and for Whitaker to come up with what they consider cause. But if they have that, he could, I think, technically fire Mueller.
David Corn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, with his thoughts there on Jeff Sessions' resignation today at President Trump's request as Attorney General. Coming up, disinformation in the midterms. Yeah, it was a factor. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. It's the day after. Whatever happened to travels in Trump's America? That's the title of a documentary project led by Bruce Hawker. He's a filmmaker from Australia. We spoke with him the first time about 10 days ago. The last month, Bruce was crossing the U.S., speaking with Americans for a film about politics here in 2018. We caught up with him again in Washington today as he was getting ready to head back home.
Hey, Marco. Good to speak to you again.
Likewise. Hope everything's going well.
It is.
You're like less than 24 hours from wheels up and going back to Australia.
Yeah, well, I got to say we're sort of looking forward to getting home after so long on the road, but it's sort of a bit, you sort of get hooked on it here, which I think is probably part of the problem for America.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you do get hooked on American politics, and maybe a little bit on, you know, the constant tweeting by Donald Trump and the reactions by people to that. There's something in that that I think is has an effect on us and probably has an effect on the American people.
What do you think that thing is?
Well, I think that he is so dominating in the social media space that people feel compelled to listen to his next contribution, whatever it is. And even though the interest may be morbid in a sense, it's still an obsession. You know, I spoke to a friend of mine in Hawaii recently who said that every day, if he doesn't get his Trump fix, he gets a little bit edgy, even though he doesn't like Trump. That's the thing that's, I think, happening in the United States at the moment, which is curious and but perhaps a little disturbing as well.
So in the last month that you've traveled 3,500 miles, 13 states, 130 interviews, what has been your biggest takeaway?
We think America is an unhappy place right now. That's the most overwhelming impression that we've received. And I don't think that's a particularly healthy thing for Americans. I don't think they like it. I think people at one level want to come together, but at another level feel that there's so much that separates them that they can't really do it. The number of people that we spoke to who said that they don't even talk to their friends or new acquaintances about politics because they know that if they're on the other side of the political fence, that's going to cause real tension.
Well, last time we spoke, you mentioned the deep divisions in this country, which, you know, is not that surprising. But how do you connect the chasms between different views that people have and that unhappiness you were just talking about?
Well, I think people feel that they shouldn't be feeling like that, you know, that there should be a greater sense of oneness in their country. And I think that has been a feature of America from in times past. But now they miss that. And I think it's a discombobulating feeling for a lot of Americans, if you know what I mean. They really feel affected adversely about it. And I think they're also exhausted by the constant conflict. And that's not a good thing. And I suspect that it's going to keep going for the next 2 years, because essentially last night we didn't really see a resolution to that conflict.
Well, this is a unique country. And on that point, my producer says, I have to ask, where are you staying?
We're staying at the Watergate Hotel in Washington. Where else would you stay when you're covering a presidential campaign?
Was that an accident?
No, it was quite deliberate, actually.
Australian documentary filmmaker Bruce Hawker. Good to speak again, and safe travels.
Thanks, Marco. Great to talk to you.
We can't reasonably talk about the midterms without talking about this.
Call it fake news, call it propaganda.
Tonight, a look inside Russia's disinformation campaign.
Another onslaught of Russian propaganda, this time flooding the internet.
For months, we've heard about Russian efforts to divide Americans and disrupt the 2016 election.
So how did coordinated disinformation campaigns play out in this election? Let me turn to Renee DiResta. She joins us from our BBC studios in Washington. Renee, you research online disinformation for the Austin-based company New Knowledge. And to be clear, we're not talking about hacking here. We're talking propaganda, disinformation, fake news. So tell us what you saw in the lead up to the midterms.
The Russians were very much involved in the midterms again this year. They've never really gone away. It's just an evolution of tactics, I would say. So what we see is increasing promotion of what we would call overt propaganda. Sites that are known to be attributed to Russian state interests, so RT, Sputnik, some of their media properties, some of their think tanks, the stuff that many folks around the world would recognize as propaganda, but American audiences are not quite as adept at recognizing it as such yet. The second thing that they do is the covert operations, working to amplify existing stories. There would be news stories in highly partisan domestic press talking about, for example, the Kavanaugh hearings. And we would see these Russian accounts, these Russian persona accounts, active in amplifying those messages, amplifying those stories. So it was a little bit different than 2016 in that they didn't do the hard work of creating the site and the Facebook page and the media brand around a particular type of activist group. They simply engaged by amplifying real material written by real Americans that appealed to the audiences that they wanted to go after.
We also heard about Iran launching a coordinated disinformation campaign that was eventually spotted by Facebook. What did that look like?
That was a campaign that was targeting the American left primarily. And in this particular case, the Iranians reached out to the American left thinking that amplifying the messages of the American left, amplifying perhaps the chance of electoral success of the American left, would benefit them. So this is sort of a find the people who are most ideologically aligned with you that are real, amplify their message, and hopefully influence the electorate. So with the Iranian pages, we saw them repurposing memes from sites like Occupy Democrats.
Did that surprise you? Because, I mean, foreign policy isn't like a big draw during the midterms, and that assumes that Iran thought, well, there'll be a lot of people on the left, progressives, who want to see this deal start up again. I mean, that seems a little tone deaf.
I think that there is a long game. So increasing your audience, increasing the prevalence of a point of view that benefits you over time is part of what we see here. So, for example, the Russian operation in 2016 began in 2014.
Are the gatekeepers at Twitter and Facebook ramped up enough, you know, in their rigor in spotting this stuff?
I think that they're doing much better, yes. So it's not perfect. But one of the things that has been really important to me to watch since 2016 is the evolution of kind of multi-stakeholderism here. So we did see Facebook take down a collection of pages just last night with a tip-off from law enforcement, we were told. And that's fantastic. That's exactly the kind of thing we want to see. We want to see that cooperation. We know that accounts that we have given to the platforms have come down. So that's the sort of thing that's the ideal state.
As someone who tracks disinformation, what are you going to be looking out for over the next 2 years?
I think it's going to be groups. I've felt this way for years now, actually, because that's where like-minded people tend to cluster. So I think that we're going to see less of the 2016 playbook of creating whole cloth media properties with sites and pages and Twitter accounts, and much more infiltration of groups.
And when you say groups, are you talking about different Facebook groups?
Yes. I'm talking about Facebook groups specifically. I think that there's an opportunity to infiltrate these more closed communities, to exert influence over communities that already do have some distribution and some audience.
Renee Duresta researches online disinformation and propaganda for the company New Knowledge. Renee, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the midterm results and the future of the immigration debate. Also, some post-election thoughts from a young woman worried about her parents getting deported.
Hopefully this points us in the right direction in getting them some type of protection.
Those stories and more still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Everyone, take a deep breath. The midterm elections are over, mostly. And now that you've taken that breath, brace yourself to hear a little more of President Trump's post-election news conference. It was chaotic, to say the least, with the president clashing with several members of the White House press corps. Here's one of the less confrontational moments, Trump's response to a question about building the wall along the border with Mexico.
Look, I speak to Democrats all the time. They agree that a wall is necessary. And as you know, we're building the wall. We've started, but we should build it at one time, not in chunks.
But you want much more money, and you want
no,
much sooner.
No, we need the money to build the wall, the whole wall, not pieces of it all over. And
I've got the world's Monica now Campbell with us. She's in San Francisco. So Trump talked about the wall, what it would take to protect the border, but he didn't really back down from any of his immigration rhetoric. So what specifically can we expect now on immigration? What's the outlook?
Well, there's a new reality. Trump is going to be challenged like he hasn't before when it comes to crackdown on immigration. How that plays out concretely, we may see in terms of enforcement. So under Trump, we've seen more immigration raids. We've seen more arrests of undocumented immigrants under Trump. And that takes cash. Cash for immigration officers, for detention centers, and Congress can now say, no, we're not going to give you the money to expand ICE. We're going to rein that in. And that means that we may see more immigrants arrested or picked up even at the border, released to fight their case from outside detention. So that's one scenario that we should look out for. Another is sending troops to the border, which requires cash. And the Democrats can also control that through the budget. The final scenario that is going to be kind of at the top of the priority list is what happens with DACA.
Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals for kids who came here as very young.
Exactly. The program for so-called dreamers, right? That's a fight that may go to the Supreme Court, or the pressure will be on the House of Representatives to bring DACA to the floor for a vote. Of course, that won't be easy because with the Republicans controlling the Senate, this will be an ongoing fight. But DACA seems to be still on the table. It may be secured for another 2 years, but you know that's a limbo that the hundreds of thousands of people in that program are going to have to withstand.
What can Trump do unilaterally, especially with the new Democratic Congress watching?
Unilaterally, he can appoint judges. He can slow down the process when it comes to having more immigration judges in the system. We just reached a backlog of immigration cases topping 1 million recently.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an astounding number. So a lot of people say, hey, instead of sending troops to the border, how about sending judges to the courtrooms to be able to clear out this backlog? That's a process that Trump can keep very slow. It's already a slow process, but that's something that they can control.
There are lots of questions about what's going to happen next. You were watching election returns last night, Monica, with a family that's feeling these questions quite personally, yeah?
Yeah, I watched the results come in with one family. They don't live far from San Francisco. And I talked to two of the sisters, Isabel and Maite. And they're in their 20s. They were born in Mexico. And Isabel has a green card through marriage. And Maite has DACA. And they've been living the ups and downs of our immigration policy for years.
And neither voted, obviously, because green card and DACA, right? What are they concerned about?
They have plenty of questions. They have questions about DACA. What's the future of that program? Will they face deportation from the United States, where they've lived most of their lives? They also worry about their parents, who are undocumented, and their parents live in a rural and much more conservative part of California, and they worry about what might happen with their parents.
They're not protected. They live in a very white community. So hopefully this points us in the right direction in getting them some type of protection that they haven't had since we got here.
But it's not going to happen under Trump, Mai. It's going to be a longer way than that. I mean, we've been talking about immigration reform for years.
Yeah, and you know, you can just sort of sense the exhaustion there. And yeah. Another thing I'd like to bring up, Marco, is that while we watched the election and the election results, for these sisters, it brought up issues again of identity and belonging and where do they belong.
So the thing is, I love this country. It has given me opportunities that I know my own country unfortunately would not have, and I know it can be better. And I consider myself an American.
Okay, Maite, you're shaking your head. When she said, I consider myself American, you're shaking your head.
Because I don't.
You don't consider yourself an American.
I don't. If I were to feel American, I wouldn't have to be fighting as hard.
So one sister feels at home, the other feels like an outsider. When you speak with immigrants, Monica, what do you hear more often, at home or outsider?
There are people who feel permanence in the United States. Millions of people who feel rooted here. They work here, they live here, they have children here, they've created businesses here, and they feel American. They may not be citizens, but they feel a part of this country. And what they've seen in terms of politics, in terms of the rhetoric in Washington, can seem, what I hear, so separate from their daily lives in the United States. And that disconnect feels very real.
Doesn't sound like that's going to change with these midterms.
No, it's a lot of limbo. It's a lot of uncertainty. It's going to be a lot of ups and downs. It's not going to get that much easier.
The World's Monica Campbell, who covers immigration for us. Now, remember Phil Seidels? He's the soybean farmer in Mechanicsburg, Illinois, we introduced you to over the summer. He told us how President Trump's trade policies, the tariffs and China's retaliation on soybeans specifically, are impacting him and his bottom line. Trade and tariffs did not turn out to be a big deal in the midterm elections, but they're still a big deal for a lot of Americans like Phil Seidels. So we checked back with him today.
Right now we're standing in a 4-H cattle shed show barn. We're looking at some calves getting some drinks of water. I don't know if you can hear that in the background. Overlooking my cattle pasture and 80-acre cut soybean field.
Today, soybean farmers like Phil Seidel's continue to be hit hard by Trump's escalating trade war with China. Seidel's having trouble selling his beans to China.
Exports are huge. Without exports, we wouldn't be in business. It's a huge impact, and China is obviously a large, large market.
And what about your farm? Is it a family farm, and how long have you been in the business?
It is. It's a third generation back farming. I farm with my grandparents and my uncle. I graduated from college in 2007, so I've had 10 years of experience under my belt, which in the ag community, where the average farmer, I believe, is 58 years old, is still green for sure.
You're a young'un.
That's right.
And those retaliatory tariffs from Beijing, how are you coping?
Oh, we're going to do what we always do. The farming community is a resilient bunch. I look at my grandparents that are 91 and 90 years old, literally lived through the Depression, made it through the 70s and the 80s with interest rates. You know, so we're going to do what we always do, and that's we're going to tighten our belts, and we're going to sharpen our pencils, and we're going to find ways to make this work.
Yeah, but if those tariffs get to be too much, I mean, can you just rely on, I don't know, nostalgia about your grandparents making it through the Depression to survive?
No, of course not. This is a business, first and foremost, and it's about profit. And we've got to make profit to be here next year. You look at the administration, you look at what they're doing. I've been farming for 10 years. I don't have a whole lot of experience of, you know, trade and what I've just known, what I've known for the last 10 years. And you have a new administration come in and they tell you that there's certain things that were going on in the trade world that aren't supposed to be going on. And you know, you believe them or you don't believe them.
Do you believe them?
I do.
How do you justify continuing to support a president whose policies are clearly affecting your livelihood?
Well, it's for the greater good, I suppose. I'm the third generation, and I hope that there'll be a fourth generation and a fifth generation behind me. And if I have been treated unfairly in the trade world, I hope that they don't have to have the same effects. And I think, you know, for the first time we've had a president that is standing up and kind of doing what the political promises were that he said he was going to do and work for fair trade for the farmer. How long will that support last, I think, is the question. That's the gray area. We don't really have an end game.
Phil Seidel's is a soybean farmer. He joined us from his farm in Mechanicsburg, Illinois. Thank you so much for the interview. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Now that Democrats control the House of Representatives, they are better positioned to try to put a brake on some of President Trump's foreign policy initiatives. But Trump reiterated at a press conference today that he's committed to his America First agenda.
I love our country. I do. You have nationalists. You have globalists. I also love the world. And I don't mind helping the world, but we have to straighten out our country first. We have a lot of problems.
Staying the course, still America first. The New Yorker Susan Glasser has been thinking how the midterm results may change the U.S. role on the world stage. What's the big picture, Susan? Are we likely to see much change in terms of how the U.S. projects power worldwide?
Well, we're not likely to see much change in the unique nature of the president, who has responded, I think, to this election setback in a very predictably Trump way by claiming it to be a victory, an incredible victory, a history-defying victory. So, you know, you got the sense listening to his press conference today, which was his longest press conference, by the way, of his presidency. Actually, foreign policy did not figure that much into it. New initiatives didn't figure that much into it. As you know, it was really largely a rhetorical defense of himself and criticism of his critics that we heard today from the president.
So let's zoom in on a couple of things on the horizon. California Democrat Representative Adam Schiff is now going to head the House Intelligence Committee, and he says reopening the probe into Russian election meddling is his top priority. What is the upshot there? More cooperation between the Hill and the Mueller investigation?
What Adam Schiff has said in the past is that they would try not to overtrack with the Mueller investigation. So in many ways, I think the Hill investigations will proceed now that Democrats control the House. But really, the question is, what is Mueller going to come up with, and how and in what form is he going to deliver his conclusions about the president to Congress? We don't know any of those things yet.
I was struck also by the number of veterans who were voted in yesterday. I mean, if you go back to 1971, 70%+ of Congress was vets, that kind of World War II factor. Prior to yesterday, that number was nearing an all-time low. And then yesterday it rose. I think of Mikey Sherrill, who now represents New Jersey in Congress. She's a former Navy pilot. How do you think this arrival of vets on Capitol Hill will change the foreign policy outlook?
Yeah, Mikey Sherrill will be in my home district where my parents are. And there were a number of national security type Democrats who ran in this race. You see a new breed stepping up and running. As you know, many of them ran these sort of very like cool, a mom and a helicopter pilot too kind of ads in the election. So that's definitely something new. And of course, the number of women, by the way, is also at historic levels. So another difference, I think, in the composition of this new Congress. But again, the House of Representatives has very limited power when it comes to foreign policy, exerts more power over national security in the sense that they exercise the power of the purse. But President Trump, of course, as you know, will still retain his largely unchecked power to direct U.S. relations in the world as he sees fit. And in fact, he will be heading right back out onto the world stage with a quick trip to Paris this weekend for the 100th anniversary of World War I.
What difference, I'm just curious, what difference will the woman factor in Congress make when it comes to foreign policy, do you think?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, again, many of the women, you know, bring significant accomplishment and experience with issues of national security and foreign policy to the table. So it'll be interesting to see if we see more of their voices than we have in the past. Historically, of course, it's been a very male-dominated subject here in Washington. You know, and again, I think the question is, what kind of accountability are Democrats going to try to impose on President Trump using their new power of control over the House of Representatives? Are they going to be investigating, for example, foreign policy subjects such as the nature of the administration's relationship with Saudi Arabia and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and what role he played, if any, in advising the president on the murder, apparent murder of the Saudis, of the journalist who writes for The Washington Post, right. Mr. Khashoggi. I think that will be very interesting and unusual use of the House's investigatory powers.
The New Yorker, Susan Glasser, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
We're taking a look at how the midterm election results will have global impact. Moving along now to climate policy with our environment reporter, Carolyn Beeler. Hey, Carolyn.
Hi, Marco.
So what's the top line for you on what happened yesterday in the midterms and how it might impact climate policy?
It's a mixed bag, really. Some big ballot initiatives in the West that would have sped the transition from fossil fuels to renewables failed, but there were some big wins in governor's races and the House.
So let's look at both those, starting with the ballot initiatives. Largely disappointing for environmentalists, yeah?
Yeah, the biggest story we were tracking was the carbon tax in Washington state, which failed pretty decisively. So did a renewable energy mandate in Arizona and a measure that would have really limited fracking in Colorado. There were two climate-related initiatives that did pass, a ban on offshore drilling in state waters in Florida, and then a renewable energy requirement in Nevada that was pretty similar to the one in Arizona, but it actually won't go into effect until it goes through another round of voting.
Gotcha. There's a different picture, though, in the gubernatorial race as Democrats picked up several governor's offices yesterday. We know, obviously, from California and outgoing Governor Jerry Brown, what can be done at the state level. How will those pickups at the governor level impact climate policy?
So that is actually probably going to have a bigger impact than those ballot initiatives in pushing for renewable energy at the state level. So going into this election, there were a dozen gubernatorial candidates that had pledged to push their states to 100% renewable energy by mid-century if they were elected. Several of those candidates were, in fact, elected, including four that flipped their states from Republican control to Democratic control. Those were Colorado, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Now, I was curious how this might impact nationwide carbon emissions. So I crunched the numbers. And those states that now have governors or governor-elects who've committed to a renewable energy transition emit about a fifth of the nation's energy-related carbon emissions. So that is a significant portion of the United States footprint, but it's obviously not the whole country.
Yeah, no, it does seem like a lot. Does that tell us, though, that action on climate change going forward will be kind of guided by states and not Washington or Trump?
That is what we've been hearing basically since President Trump took office from environmentalists. You know, action is shifting to the state and local level. But I think one takeaway in this election for me is how difficult and sort of piecemeal action on this giant global problem will be if you're fighting these battles at the state level.
And what about the news, Carolyn, of the House flipping from Republican to Democratic? How's that going to change climate policy coming out of Washington?
I think we're probably going to see some energy and climate-related proposals coming out of the House that die in the Senate. We saw some representatives who don't accept the science of climate change get voted out of office, and several candidates who do were voted in, including Lizzie Fletcher in the suburban Houston House race we profiled last week that went from Republican to Democratic. And this flip also means that a climate change denier, Lamar Smith, will no longer be heading up the House Science Committee.
We've been watching and talking about these midterms, but you've also been looking abroad for perspectives on how climate and politics play together, right?
That's right. Australia is an interesting parallel case because it's one of the few countries besides the United States where climate skeptics have a lot of political power. So I wanted to see how that played out in elections there. So I spoke to Amanda McKinsey, who heads up the nonprofit called the Climate Council. And she started by telling me about a recent election for the Australian House a couple of weeks ago, where climate change ended up playing a decisive role.
Climate change has been consistently a part of Australian elections since 2007, and it's been a big part in some of those elections. Most recently, there's been a by-election in the seat of Wentworth, which was Malcolm Turnbull, our former Prime Minister's seat, and climate change was the number one issue for voters in that election. Eastern Australia is experiencing a very severe drought at the moment, and people remember droughts of the past and what that means for urban water supplies and food prices, etc. So it's a big concern. So I think it was a top-of-mind issue for people in the seat of Wentworth.
And what about more broadly on the national level? I'm wondering if you can give me a snapshot of what Australians think of climate change, whether it's happening, whether it's man-made, and how important it is when they go to the polls.
So consistently for the last 10 years, the vast majority of Australians have said climate change is happening, I'm concerned about it, and I want the government to act. And it's been varying between sort of a 70% and 80% of Australians in the public polling. In terms of does that mean that Australians vote on the issue, I think it's part of a combination of factors. So people have a range of things that are coming up. Health and education tend to be top tier issues, economy, jobs, etc. But climate change is part of the mix. Water is a big concern in Australia because particularly most of our East Coast cities, if they're not experiencing drought, they are still experiencing some level of water insecurity from time to time. So there is rising concern across electorates.
I know that climate change policies have contributed to the ouster of more than one prime minister. Can you tell me about some of those prime ministers who've been sort of pushed out of office, partly at least due to energy and climate change policies?
It's been a complex issue for Australia. Four prime ministers have been ousted after pursuing climate policies, either for good or for bad. And this is where there's been a substantial difference between how the public view climate change and what is happening in the parliament. So public opinion polling has found that the majority of Australians want action from Parliament. But then once the issue is in the Parliament and is being debated, it is much more complex to get a solution. And that's because significant vested interest in Australia, particularly coal. So there's been a variety of policies that have been developed, but for the most part have been totally dismantled.
You mentioned drought in Wentworth. Do events like drought and the massive bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef move the needle on the politics of climate change?
Absolutely. With the drought underpinning people's consciousness going into the next federal election, Scott Morrison, our current Prime Minister, will be viewed on whether he's thinking about the future or he's stuck in the past.
Amanda McKinsey, CEO of Australia's Climate Council, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Amanda McKinsey speaking there with my colleague Carolyn Beeler about how climate change impacts Australia's politics. A lot of parallels with the U.S. there. A final note for the day, wishing you and your family happiness, prosperity, and joy. Happy Diwali, the festival of lights that Hindus around the world are celebrating this week. Those fireworks are from Kolkata in southern India. India's Supreme Court has put new restrictions on fireworks because of air pollution. Locals are split on the new rules.
It does feel very polluted. There's a lot of smog around. It's pretty difficult to breathe also. But still, you know, I mean, everybody celebrates the festival. So why not?
It's a waste of money. It's a waste of the environment. It's a waste of everything.
All over the world, there are crackers once or twice a year. New Year's are there.
But why only in Diwali and only in India? Why not ban in diesel cars?
Diesel cars. One idea. Diwali's not just about fireworks. It's family time. And Buddhists, Sikhs, and Jains also celebrate the holiday. Togetherness rules. After all, this festival is about the triumph of light over darkness, good over evil. So stay connected, stay together. That's all from us today. I'm Marco Werman from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.